season. Let's talk about campaigning. And then we're going to check in with the state on insurance rates for health insurance, because the rates have gone up. The increases were approved. So we're going to find out more about that. And then money, markets, and mayhem. It's always good to find out what's going on with the markets and how it affects our money. And then at the end of the show today, we're going to follow up with Melissa Gillette from Pura regarding those hearings with Eversource and United Illuminating after the recovery from Isaias, or maybe the lack of recovery, I should say. That was part of the problem there. But first, it's the campaign school at Yale, and who better than Patty Russo to join us and tell us all about the campaign school at Yale. So, yeah. Patty, first of all, great to see you. We were just saying it's been like at least one lifetime, if not two, since we've seen each other. From the days of the Permanent Commission on the Status of Women, which, as you said, not so permanent.
Not so permanent.
Oops. So how long have you been with the campaign school at Yale?
Well, really on and off since its inception, Anne, which is now 26 years. So last year at Yale Law School, which is where we hold our 5-day intensive, we celebrated our 25th year at the school. Quite a watershed moment. It was really, really exciting. And then unfortunately, due to COVID, we had to cancel our 5-day school at Yale Law School.
Were you able to even do virtual, or you had to just cancel it for this year?
In fact, here's the joke. I feel like we've been busier than ever in COVID. Meanwhile, I still have a full tank of gas in my car, and since mid-March, okay?
Yes.
We've never been busier. So when COVID hit in mid-March, we started getting all these calls from our grads who were running for office, have never run in a pandemic before. Patty, I can't go door to door. I can't even meet with a group of people. You know, I can't have conversations live with people. How am I going to run? How am I going to be able to get my point across? How are they even going to know that I'm running for office?
Right.
So that's when we put together a whole new level of training digitally. Everything's on Zoom, as you know, called Campaigning in the New Normal.
Yes.
And fortunately, so many of our faculty from our 5-day intensive at Yale Law School offered up and have been leading these sessions since mid-March, all different aspects of campaign training. They were so enthusiastically received, Dan, that now we've opened them up to anybody who has found themselves in the unique predicament of running for office right now. It's really, really difficult.
And
we provide them free of charge.
We
didn't want money to be another barrier to people getting the help that they needed. And it's our way to give back to, you know, paying it forward to our country right now.
You know, and you kind of touched on something I was going to ask you, because I know that I guess we should have started with what is the campaign school at Yale.
Okay.
Yeah, but I'll let you answer that. But part of the question is, because I know it's sort of focused on women. And so is it only women?
No, it is not.
Has it ever been only women, or has it always been for everyone?
Yeah, it's always been predominantly women, always. So until this year, we were the Women's Campaign School at Yale. But we started collaborating with more and more non-binary individuals and men who are running campaigns for women who are bereft. You know, they need help. They're like, you know, I'm running for office. I don't know how to do it. Help me. Or I'm a man and I'm running the campaign for a female candidate. I don't know. I know that there are challenges that women face that men don't even have to think about. Help me be a better campaign manager. Let me come to your school. And so that was the genesis behind the name change. I have to say that the mission remains the same, and the mission has always been to increase the number of women in the political pipeline. And that remains constant.
And is that to increase the women in the pipeline as candidates, or as candidates and just in the political system, not necessarily out front, but maybe a job that's not the candidate, but somewhere else in the political system?
I mean, we need more women everywhere in leadership.
That's in the world.
In the world.
Exactly.
You look at the numbers, and we are nowhere near to close to parity anywhere.
Right.
But our focus is on politics. So yes, the increasing the number of women running for office, increase the number who are running campaigns. When you think of presidential campaigns, for instance, you think of women who've run presidential campaigns. You think of Donna Brazile on the Democratic side, and you think of Kellyanne Conway on the Republican side, and then we're in free fall.
Yeah.
Women in political appointments. We need more women in political appointments as well. So we just need more women everywhere. That's my bottom line. We
We could
already
just
need.
leave it at that. We need
We
more
just leave
women
it at that.
everywhere.
And it's like pick a field. We need more women. I mean,
Yeah.
that's just really basically it. But our focus is on politics. We are a nonpartisan, issue neutral political campaign training program, which means you don't have to be pro or con an issue and to come to our school. We truly are nonpartisan. And so I think that that just brings together different perspectives, political perspectives of individuals that would never normally be getting together because things are so paralyzed right now. The
Right.
Democrats talk to the Democrats, the Republicans talk to the, and nobody's talking to each other.
Everybody's in an echo chamber. They're all
Exactly.
surrounded by people who think the same thing they think, and then they just keep repeating the same message to each other, and every any con I was going to say conflicting, but just different, opposing, alternate message is greeted with, hostility almost.
Right. Well, it's because we've forgotten how to learn how to talk to each other, how to have a civil conversation together. Well, our students have the opportunity to do that because we break them up into small case study groups, Democrats, Republicans, independents. 8 to 10% of the women who attend our school are from other parts of the world. So there's an international component to our school. So as a result of that collaboration, you have an opportunity to hear what other people are thinking and trying to better understand their perspectives.
Well, hear what they're thinking and actually listen to them. I say it all the time about anything, not just politics, but if you can't explain the other person's point of view and why they have that point of view, then you don't really understand the issue. You're just expressing your opinion again. In other words,
Correct.
you don't have to agree with them, but you really need to understand what they think and why they think it. Because then, okay, now you at least can understand where they're coming from. And maybe you can have a conversation if you're trying to reach a compromise. I feel like right now, no one's trying to reach a compromise. Everyone's just trying to cram their ideas down somebody else's throat. And the whole game has changed where we're just going to try to have more people so we can outnumber you and get what we want, instead of the idea, which was what it's supposed to be, which is to work together and compromise and come up with a solution that everybody is kind of okay with, at least that they can live
Exactly.
with, they're happy with. Maybe we tweak it as we go forward, but that's not what's happening right now. Right
Right.
now, it's an all or nothing.
Exactly. And I think back to gosh, over 30 years ago when I started my political career in campaigning. And at the time I was working for Chris Dodd. And when Chris Dodd won, he was our United States Senator at the time. When he won and I went to DC to meet with him, there he is laughing up a storm with his best buddies in the United States Senate, John McCain, Teddy Kennedy, Bob Dole, and Chris Dodd. I mean, can you even imagine that scenario happening today? They were
Yeah.
able to collaborate. They got to know each other as people. And so as a result of that, that benefited the legislation that they were able to create together to support the American people.
Absolutely. So, all right, we're going to take a break now for traffic and weather here on WICC 600. We'll come back. We're going to talk more with Patty Russo and the Campaign School at Yale. And a reminder, if you have questions, please call us 203-333-9422. So if you have questions about the Campaign School, Patty would be happy to answer them, right? All
I will.
right. All right. Right
Wonderful.
now, traffic and weather. We'll be right back. Ann Carrick here, your guest host again today. And my guest this hour, Patty Russo from the Campaign School at Yale. And, I didn't even ask. I assume Patty is fine. I know you're really Patricia Russo.
Yes, Patty really is fine.
Okay,
We're
good.
family.
That's right. So you were talking about, all sorts of challenges that people are facing because of the pandemic, trying to campaign without being in front of people. We kind of like glossed right over, though, the fact that women face different challenges, or I should say additional challenges. They probably seem all they have all the same challenges as men when they're running. And then on top of that, their own challenges. I'm going to guess that maybe minorities, like women who are of color, have yet another layer of challenges. So these are some of the things that you address at the campaign school, right?
Yes. If your listeners go on our website, which is tcsyale.org, under facts, there is a sample agenda for the from the 5-day course at Yale Law School, and they'll see how comprehensive it is because we want to make sure that our students are ready for anything that comes their way after they leave us after the phenomenal 5 days that they have with us.
Right.
We mimic the energy of a political campaign, and so your listeners who have been through the rigors of that know how intensive it is. We start very early in the morning. We're training all day, early into early evening. We all have dinner together. Since I'm Italian, we eat well. So
That's a
and then
requirement when you're in
it is a
charge.
requirement. The food is included in the tuition. That's how serious we are about the food. And then at the, after dinner, we give them their homework assignment, and we break them up into small groups. And again, that's what I said. We just randomly throw them together: Democrats, Republicans, independents, internationalists. So it's more about, gosh, I want my team to do well versus being aligned with a political party.
Imagine that teamwork
It's
in politics. Oh my gosh.
pretty amazing. And long beyond the 5 days, we have a very active closed Facebook alumni page. So when I'm traveling, which is in normal circumstances, I'll reach out to the grads on our Facebook page, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to be in DC next week. Who wants to have breakfast with me? If you've got good news to share, I'd love to hear it. If you're floundering, you need to see me. If you're in trouble with your campaign, you need to see me. Because that's when we lose a lot of women in, when they're running and they start being filled with self-doubt. Oh, this is too hard. I can't do it. No, you're just having an off day. You're just having an off day. So a lot of times we just have conversations with our students to just kind of shift them
So
back
so
to a plan.
even after they've finished, you're still sort of there as a mentor coach,
Yes. You
you
know, the
know.
mentoring component and for women candidates is as critical as the exemplary training that they're receiving from us because that's when women drop out. A lot of times when women don't have what I call a political love tribe, people that are going to be there just for them, that's when women drop out. That's when they say, oh no, I can't do this. I thought I could, but I can't. We just are there for them 24/7. During the last presidential conventions 4 years ago, there were all these pictures on our Facebook page of Democrats who were traveling to Philly who were having dinner with their Republican girlfriends from the campaign school while they were there. You don't see a lot of that collaboration happening and a genuine connection and fondness for one another.
Well, that's good to hear. We're gonna break in a couple minutes for traffic, but tell people what some of those extra challenges are for women
Well,
when they're trying to be in politics, whether they're the candidate or in some other role, that maybe don't exist for men, just to as a differentiation.
Well, just as an example, since COVID, women have been hit disproportionately by this moment that we're in, Anne. Many of them were furloughed from their jobs, lost their jobs, lost their childcare, lost their teachers. So many of them were running for office. Just try to imagine this. You're running for office, you're looking for a job. And you're your child's teacher. You're
Right.
making dinner. You're doing the lot. You're multitasking, which is kind of what what we do as a
Right.
gen. It's who we are. But imagine, imagine all those challenges. In addition to the normal challenges of wait your turn, you're too young, you're too old. We have a guy in the wings who we really want to we really want to move him forward, You know, what makes you think you can do this? Who's going to vote for you? Just all of these kinds of challenges. How are you going to raise the money? All of those things we attack and deal with during our 5-day intensive at Yale Law School.
And, well, I imagine anybody who is going to run for office, especially the first time, you know, like they've never done it before. This is their first thing. Even though you watch it from outside looking in, when you're trying to do it yourself, you know, how in the world do you raise that kind of money? And like you said, and do all the things you need to do to keep your life running while you're trying to, you know, be out getting to know people, letting them get to know you, talking about the issues, learning more about some of the issues that maybe you didn't know about, you know, all of those kind of things.
Exactly.
There's a lot going on there at the same time.
And it really is a business. Politics is a business. So when people treat it as a hobby, or they'll see somebody really dynamic on television, like Rosa DeLauro, right?
Right.
Oh my God, she's a dynamo. She's a rock star. I want to be Rosa. How hard can it be? They have no idea.
How hard can it be? All right, we're going to take a break here because it's time for traffic and weather at WICC 600. But Patty's not going anywhere. So if you have questions,
I have a lot to share.
Oh, boy. So if you have questions about campaigning, this is your chance to call in and just ask the source. Otherwise, traffic and weather, we're going to check some news as well, and we'll be right back here on Connecticut Today. And Ann Carrick here, your guest host for most of the week. Today and tomorrow I still have left. And my guest this hour is Patty Russo with the Campaign School at Yale, which is tcsyale.org if you want to know more. And she's happy to take questions, so 203-333-9422 if you want to know about campaigning and how to get into it or how to support a campaign, any all of the above, anything campaigning related. Patty's the person to go to. Is that a fair assessment?
That's fair.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit. You know, we've talked about that women have some extra challenges and that the focus of the school has always been to kind of help advance women, I'll say, in the political arena, whether they're as the candidate or running a campaign or in some other position. You know, but nothing in life is free. So let's talk about the costs, the fees, the funding, you know. Like how does the campaign school continue to exist and provide the services it does, especially you said you had all these extra services you were doing now that were digital and remote and free. Nothing in life is really free. So how do you make it all happen?
And I'm constantly fundraising. Constantly. I think every executive director of a nonprofit organization will say the same thing, that we are constantly fundraising.
And who are the people who are most likely to give money to the school?
People who believe passionately in our mission, that love what we're doing and the way in which we're doing it. You know, that's our donor base. We have Republicans, Democrats, Independents. I just believe in the way in which we deliver the program, the importance of getting more women in the pipeline, the importance of training. Quite frankly, I believe that this business has gotten so complicated and so expensive, and to your point, that everyone needs to be trained. But our focus has always been on women because we are just, you know, the numbers are just bleak still. You know, still under 30% here in our home state. Yeah. And you wonder, like, what more is it going to take to get women in the pipeline? We know that training helps exponentially. We know that because we know then that when women are armed with the information that they need to skew themselves for success, to run an effective campaign, they're going to avoid all those rookie expensive mistakes that you make because you don't know any better.
Right.
You know, you don't know, gosh, I want to see my name and my photo on a billboard on 95. Everybody wants to see a billboard up, right? And what we explain to our students is, well, all the truck drivers are going to know your name and your face, but they're going to be going through the state of Connecticut.
Right.
They can't support you. So just explaining, you know, how to use your money, because you're going to work hard to raise that money, right? How to use your money successfully and effectively. So you're getting the biggest bang out of your buck.
Right. And people who go to the school pay something to go to the
yeah.
school as
so
well.
Our tuition for the 5-day intensive is $1,800. And it includes the entire program for the 5 days. And
the food.
And the food. Because, you know, as I said, food is important. You cannot think if you're hungry.
No, that's true. Now, do they stay at the school or?
We all stay at the Marriott Courtyard on Whaley Avenue.
Is that part of the $1,800?
It is not.
Okay.
So the tuition covers the program and the food.
Okay.
So everything else is extra and has to be paid for by individual students. So the hotel that we stay in, as well as travel. You know, there's not much travel for students who are coming from Connecticut, but we have students coming from all over the country and the world. So we feel that there's no time like today to start learning how to fundraise for yourself. Right. If you're going to be an effective candidate, you've got to learn how to raise money. And they do a phenomenal job. I mean, to your point about social media, there's so many great opportunities for them with GoFundMe and other vehicles like that they basically raise the money in no time to get to the school.
Okay.
They are determined and they make it happen for themselves.
All right. And it's time for another check of traffic and weather here on WICC 600. And we'll come back and talk more with Patty Russo with the Campaign School at Yale. Welcome back. Ann Carrick, the guest host today and tomorrow, and Patty Russo is my guest this hour. We're talking about the Campaign School at Yale. You know, we went to the break. We were talking about a bunch of things about the Campaign School. You talked about people traveling from other places and learning to raise money now because that's part of campaigning. You know, are there other schools in the country or in other countries that are sort of attempting to do the same thing, whether they're focused on women or not?
Yeah, there sure are.
Okay.
Folks can
obviously we think yours is best. I know you do.
Well, we have been at it for a very long time. I don't know any other school, quite frankly, that's been at it for 25 years. That is a 5-day intensive that has the model that we do.
Right.
But there are other options out there, and your listeners should Google, you know, campaign schools, and I think they'll be pleasantly surprised and amazed at just how many there are out there, which is really exciting. There are local, sometimes there are local opportunities, statewide opportunities. Sometimes the political parties will run training programs for women who are interested in running for office. So there are so many more opportunities now than there were certainly when we started 25 years ago.
Sure. And I know you wanted to talk about the fact that we just had National Voter Registration Day.
Yes.
Yes.
Yesterday. I've extended it. It's National Voter Registration Day today as well, Anne.
Okay.
And it's going to be until October 27th, which is the deadline.
In Patty's world.
On November 3rd. Now, this is what leadership looks like, right? That's the only space. And it's just so important, Anne, as you know, that everybody vote, you know, everybody exercise their right to vote. It's the most precious thing we have as a United States citizen. It's so important that our voice be heard and that we vote.
I would also encourage people to be informed, like take the time to find out who's running for which offices in your area and what they think and what they want to do, so you know
exactly
who you want to vote for.
Exactly. You've got to make sure that whoever you're deciding to cast your vote for is aligned with your principles and what you believe, to make sure that they will indeed be representing you well on the state and on the local, state and federal levels.
Absolutely. And also, you know, a lot of people will have said, if you don't vote, then you really can't be complaining, you know.
That doesn't stop people, but
no,
it's true.
If you don't at least go vote,
right,
and you have the right to vote, then
right,
kind of stop whining. You know, there are people who are from other countries. They're not U.S. citizens. They're here legally and they work here. And so they whine a bit because they can't vote. They can't do anything but live with the consequences of whoever is in office. But if you are a citizen and you can vote and you don't, then I don't have a lot of sympathy for your complaints if you don't like the
Exactly.
outcome, you know.
Exactly. Absolutely. No, it's so important. And, so many campaigns that are going on right now, they're utilizing volunteers in a very different way, right? Because, again, there are very few, again, depending upon your state and where you live, some people feel comfortable going door to door. Most do not. So the way they're utilizing their volunteers, you could actually be making a difference in the comfort of your own home and support a candidate.
Right. Well, that's a different way. And I'm sure like social media and video conversations are, like everything else we're doing right now, everything is being conducted electronically if it can be, just for safety's sake.
Exactly. Everything. Facebook, more critical than ever, and other social media platforms. Absolutely.
Talk a little bit about what people who are campaigning now are doing. I know you said, at the beginning of the hour, you talked about how that you couldn't have the intensive class this year. You had to cancel it. You couldn't do it virtually, but you are offering all sorts of other assistance digitally to help people. But what are some of the things that people are doing that, to compensate for the fact that they can't have town halls and be in person in places and do all those kind of things?
Well, what they're doing is they're magnifying the things that we can do. So, for instance, phone banking has gotten very, very popular again. So early on, when the pandemic hit, we recommended to our attendees on our Zoom presentations that they call senior citizens in their districts, just checking in. Hi, I'm Kate Farrar. I'm running for office in your district. Just wanted to check on you, see how you're doing, because many of the seniors are alone in their homes. So they really appreciated the call. So it was a soft touch. It was just, I care about you. This is our district, and I care about you. How are you doing?
And I imagine in smaller communities that's even more effective.
It was very effective. People had time, Anne, for phone calls.
But I was going to say, especially in a community where you may know each other, even if it's casually or informally, to have the person call and check in on you. I mean, if I had a candidate call and check in on me, I'd be like, "Who are you?" Because but as I said, if it's somebody you kind of know and they're like, "Hey, just thought I'd reach out and see
It's
how's it
good.
going," that's
It's very
different.
nice. It's very nice. So that has been very well received. And then a lot of them have been sharing their voter registration list in their district. And they have volunteers that are writing postcards to friends. So the campaign provides the postcards and labels them for you, send you a list, and the volunteer will write a personal note in support of that candidate and send it to a friend.
Wow. Okay. All right. We're going to take another break for traffic and weather. We'll be back to talk a little bit more to Patty Russo about the campaign school at Yale. And this is going to be your last chance, if you have questions for her, to call in and ask her questions about how to run a campaign. But right now, traffic and weather, WICC 600. Ann Carrick in as your guest host today, and again tomorrow, one more day of me. And right now, Patty Russo is here with the campaign school at Yale, which, just in case somebody just popped in, basically helping people who haven't run for office before or who want to work on a campaign, or maybe they're trying to help run a campaign for someone who hasn't run before. And so, a 5-day intensive school to kind of go over everything you need to know to get up and running. And then you mentioned earlier, not only to get you going, but even when you're in the throes of it, ongoing sort of mentoring, coaching. So if somebody went to the school and now they're struggling a bit, they can call you and be like, "Patty, I
I get a lot of those calls, Anne, especially right now. We're 41 days out to Election Day. So it's kind of my peak season for those kinds of calls.
Sure.
The other program I just wanted to talk about, because a lot of people are taking advantage of this new relatively new program. So 4 years after the presidential, many women called us and were shocked at the results. They wanted to run for office. They'd never run before. They wanted to be politically engaged. And then many of them went to D.C. and they marched in the first Global Women's March in January 2017. And that's when we started really getting slammed with calls. Women called us. I want to run. I said, great. Where are you registered to vote? Oh, I'm not registered to vote. So we had to have
Wait. They want to run, but they're not registered to vote. Come on.
You are not coming to the campaign school at Yale. So a third of the women who reached out to us after that march weren't even registered to vote.
Wow.
So I told them how to register to vote, how to get registered. And I gave them a local political homework assignment. And I said, you're either going to love it and I'll see you in 6 months, or you're going to hate it. And you're going to say, what was I thinking? No, this isn't for me. And then the other third were registered to vote, but didn't bother to vote in the presidential because, quote, the two candidates were so similar, Patty, I couldn't make up my mind. So two thirds of the women who reached out to us after that first Global Women's March weren't ready for a 5-day intensive.
Yeah.
And so what we did was we raised money, Anne, to create a whole new level of training called the Campaign School at Yale, the Basics, which is a 1-day intensive. So if you have a newly discovered passion for politics and you want to think about maybe running for office one day, or think about running a campaign, or even learning how to be an effective leader in your community on an issue that you feel passionately about, join us. That is the beauty of the 1 day. If you have
to sort of figure out if this is what you want to do or not.
This is for me. Exactly. Okay. So we literally have had thousands and thousands come to that program.
Wow.
Spend the day with us. And that we've been able to provide virtually. So we have run two of those since COVID, and we had close to 1,000 people on both those calls.
Wow.
One of them was for Republican women only. We partnered with a group called Republican Women for Progress. Because if you look at the numbers, we have right now 298 women running for Congress, both the House and the Senate. Of that 298, Anne, 204 are Democrats. Only 94 are Republicans.
Whoa.
They're just kind of limping along.
Yeah.
So there's a group that we have partnered with, Republican Women for Progress. They do early recruitment. They help them with fundraising. And we do the training with them. And Republican women are just so grateful for the support because, you know, unlike other campaign training options on the Democratic side, there really isn't a lot available for Republican women.
And I feel like it's also like a little like politically incorrect sometimes for women to say they're Republicans. Like a lot of people think that if you're female, you should automatically align with the Democratic Party because of certain issues. But there's still a lot of women who, you know, a lot of the issues they agree with Republicans on.
Correct.
And so it's good to have something like that.
Right. Women are not monolithic in their thinking. And I think we saw that during the last presidential where, you know, white women were the ones who voted, you know, overwhelmingly for Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton. And it was women of color who voted overwhelmingly for Hillary Clinton. So that's your point completely, that women are not, you know, not monolithic in their thinking. We're all over the place.
Right. Well, and that's a little off topic, but that's part of the issue right now with everything being so divisive and both parties, I feel like kind of moving to their extreme corners, is they've left so many people behind. You know, there's all these people who, you know, they're somewhere closer to the middle and the parties are kind of drifting in both directions.
And that's where the American people are. The majority of the American people, Anne, are in the middle. So we're really missing out, aren't we?
I feel like we are. I keep saying I feel like the first candidate who is closer to the center will attract more people. But again, will they ever find a party that will have them? Will they have a team to join?
Exactly.
Or do they have to be more extreme just to have the team play, to have the team effort behind them?
Exactly.
And that's a problem.
It's a conundrum. It really is. It's really a challenge. And I know many of us are thinking, well, when are we going to start swinging? You know how the pendulum swings?
Yes.
When is that going to happen?
Oh.
Not anytime soon. You know, when U.S. Senator Barbara Mikulski of Maryland was the Dean of the Women of the United States Senate, she would host a dinner party for just the Republican and the Democratic female senators in her home, not with staff, just them.
Right.
Let's let our hair down. Let's get to know each other. Let's talk about issues that we can support together.
Exactly. All right, we're going to take a break here for traffic and weather. And when we come back, I'd like you to give us a few names, if you can, of people that we might know who were who are alums of the school. But right now, traffic and weather on WICC 600. And Carrick here, your guest host, and my guest this hour. We're wrapping up the first hour with Patty Russo from the Campaign School at Yale. So we've been talking about all the great things that the school does to help people run for offices or support a campaign, and now you have this one day class. If somebody's thinking, I think I might want to run, is this for me? Which I'm guessing is similar to the homework assignment you gave that person who was considering it. So before we run out of time here, give us some examples of people who are grads or alums of the school that we might know. So, this, yeah, go ahead.
United States Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York. She's a proud grad of our school. Former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords of Arizona. Not only is a grad of our school, but served on our board of directors for many years.
Okay.
We have a rock star in Congress right now. Her name is Lauren Underwood. Lauren's really making her mark. She's a registered nurse, so that kind of dispels all the myths about how, you have to be a lawyer in order to run for office.
So there's hope for me because I'm not an
There's hope for
attorney.
you. Exactly. So, Lauren ran in a Democratic primary in Illinois against, I don't know, six or seven white men. She is a young African American woman, and ran and won handily, beat out all of her opponents in the primary, and then went on to beat out a 20-year Republican incumbent, and she's up for re-election now.
Wow, a true success story.
Exactly. And so, and so many of our grads are serving in a variety of different levels, many of them on the local level and then in the state house and the state senate. And it's just so exciting, again, thanks to Facebook, to see so many of them right now. We've got Nikema Williams in Georgia, who's running for John Lewis's seat in the United States Congress.
Wow. All right, so
So,
we're about to run out of time. So if somebody's interested, tcsyale.org, is that the best place to go?
TCSYale.org, or they can call me 203-734-7385. I will have a call with anybody
Okay,
who's
thank you very
thinking
much,
about it.
Patty Russo. News.
Thank you.
Markets, money, and mayhem. And who better than Jenny Van Leeuwen Harrington to explain everything for us and then some. So, Jenny, thanks again for being back.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. I always feel honored since I know you do things like CNBC, which has a slightly broader listening viewing audience than we do here, but we appreciate it.
I love being on, and I love doing it in the state of Connecticut. So
Okay, well,
thank you
that's
for having
good. So we'll start with like kind of just a little update, with the pandemic. What's it doing with the markets? What's the latest news in that area?
So it's been really interesting. I was on a call this morning that JP Morgan hosted with a political strategist, and one of the things he said is that the market's really responding to pandemic-related news, like, when's the vaccine coming? Openings, closings, reopenings, all of that. And that's what the market's responding to. But the reality is at this point, the stock market should be looking past that because we have a pretty good handle on what's going on there. We're pretty confident that we're getting a vaccine between maybe November-ish and year end. We're pretty confident that by next year, we're going to be, by this time next year, we'll be back to normal in terms of our daily actions. What the market should be more focused on, and this is up for debate if it is or isn't, is on the election, because you have in some ways two reasonably different outcomes given a Biden win or a Trump win. So while the market is still focusing on the pandemic and on vaccines, the reality is that it should be moving on and should be looking at issues that are going to have a bigger impact.
Right. It's interesting because that was one of the questions that I had for you was, you know, like a local company here in Connecticut in Shelton announced last week that they had a COVID treatment that's ready for human trials, not a vaccine, but actually, so if you get sick, what you can take to get over it. And I was curious if things like that do affect the markets. And so it sounds like you're saying they are still affecting the markets, but that experts are saying it really shouldn't be the case at this point.
Right. It seems like, I mean, overall, I'd say, yeah. And so with respect to the Shelton company and the therapeutics, at this point, that's not having a big impact on the market.
Okay.
So, you know, way back maybe in April or May, when Gilead came out with a therapeutic, and then there were other therapeutics, the market was moving like crazy on that. So right now, the therapeutics are not having a big impact. And I would say overall, there is as much emotion driving the stock market today as I think I've ever seen.
In all your years of doing this.
In all my 25 years of doing this, there is a lot of emotion. So I think that's really, really what we're seeing at play. When you hear like reopening stocks, you know, technology, you know, stay closed stocks, all that. It's really just people at the end of it all reacting and having emotional responses.
I that could just be because people are feeling very uneasy about what is the future, what's going to happen. And so maybe that's just playing out in the markets as well. Because, I mean, even in my situation, which is not nearly as changed as some other people's, you know, there's still a lot of like, I don't really know what's going to be happening in the future. You know, what is my work situation going to be? You know, what companies are going to go out of business, like the places that I go and frequent, you know, for services of my own. And I do also sort of question the economy in general. You know, there's a lot of businesses that have sort of been hanging on. And so I wonder, you know, are they going to make it? Are we going to have a lot of businesses closing? And is that going to have an impact overall on the economy and the markets in addition to an election?
Right. And so all your questions are just totally spot on. And I think the thing is that for the most part, I don't know. And you don't know. And nobody knows.
Time for the crystal ball.
Right. And so, you know, we went from a point of maximum fear, which was March, and then we kind of hit a point of maximum hopefulness, which was really up until the end of August when the market had actually rallied and was positive on the year. And now I think some reality is setting in. And I think that I don't know and those questions are coming in. And we all know the old adage, the market hates uncertainty more than anything else.
Right.
And I think we're acknowledging right now that there is uncertainty. So actually, I don't know if everyone listening knows this already, but the stock market had a bad day today. The S&P was down about almost 2.5%, 2.4%. And I think that doesn't unnerve me or scare me. To me, that's just okay. It's healthy. You know, at this point right now that the market's kind of flat on the year, and to be nervous and to be questioning and to be saying, we just don't know and we don't have great clarity is fine, because we do not know what the real fallout of all of this is going to be. We're just now moving off of where people had the $600 a week from the fiscal stimulus.
Right.
They had that's no longer there. So we don't know what real grocery shopping is going to look like.
Right.
We don't know what businesses are going to close. I think
the announcement of layoffs on some big companies that had not until this point laid people off, you know, and where they seem to have, it seems like a lot of companies maybe heading into the last quarter, they're sort of reevaluating and saying, all right, we need to cut some people because, you know, we thought by now we would be, you know, back on keel, and instead we're still kind of hurting. So we're going to let people go.
Right. Now, I think the reality is a lot of that is going to be offset with massive hirings elsewhere. You know, some companies are thriving. Many companies are thriving because of this. And whenever you see one of those just huge title shifts, then change, the interim between during the change becomes scary and kind of rocks and rolls emotions and the market. And it does get scary. I've been having so many conversations with clients this week. And whichever side of the political aisle people are on, they're scared.
Right.
And
are they out on the ledge again, as you said before?
You know, I'm keeping them pulled pretty far back from the ledge.
Oh, good. Good to know. Good to know.
That takes a lot of straps and devices.
Everybody's on a leash at this point, just in case.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Two or three leashes. observations.
Yeah. I mean, from my perspective, I'm not the financial person, you know, but with everything that's happened in 2020, personally, like with my own investments, I feel like if we end the year flat from where we started, I'm good.
Hallelujah.
I'm good with that. Right. Because I mean, with everything that's gone on this year and all the uncertainty and the fears and, you know, I'm like, flat is fine with me. You know,
I am 100% with you. Flat would be beautiful.
Right. I don't know. I haven't really looked lately because, you know, I'm a little nervous. Like, how far away from flat are we at this point?
No. The S&P, even after today, is still up. It's still
okay.
Up.
So we're still on track for flat.
Right.
Okay.
I heard there's a terrific behavioral economist, a guy named Shlomo Bernazzi, who is a professor at UCLA. And I heard him speak in April. And one of the things that he said is really, as an investor, the healthiest way to behave is to really only check your portfolio statement once a year. That might be a little bit extreme, but you can think of how much more pleasant this year might have been had you checked your portfolio on December 31st and checked it again now. You'd say, oh, great, I'm up 1.5%. How nice.
Yeah, that's right. The year's going pretty well. Excellent.
Nice.
Right. Maybe this is why so many of them have shifted to only issuing statements quarterly.
Right.
So for the nervous Nellies, they have to log in and go look on their own. Nobody's going to just remind them, like, hey, you have some investments. Do you want to see how they're doing? You know?
So, right.
Exactly. All right. We're going to take a break for traffic and weather here at WICC 600. We'll come back and talk a lot more with Jenny Van Leeuwen-Harrington from Gilman Hill Asset Management about money and markets. Of course, that's what we're talking about. And we'll take questions if you have them. So don't leave us. WICC 600, traffic and weather. And Carrick here, your guest host, and my guest this hour, Jenny Van Leeuwen-Harrington with Gilman Hill Asset Management. So we were talking about the markets, the pandemic, that, you know, everything is very, people are still very uneasy and emotional, and it's affecting the markets, even though experts are saying that the pandemic itself really shouldn't be affecting the markets so much. You mentioned interest rates during the break, and I had seen a news story that said the Fed expects to leave interest rates near zero through at least 2023, it was a sign of patience as officials try to revive the economy. That was the headline. So I'm guessing that you can elaborate on the interest rate situation.
Right. So I had an interesting conversation with a client yesterday, and this guy is really sophisticated. He spent his whole career as an asset allocator, and he phrased it very well when he said, low interest rates are destroying the investing class. And what he means is for regular people who've saved their whole lives and have a portfolio, and that's going to support their retirement, and they want to have it be pretty safe, so they want some in stocks and some in bonds, there's no return to be had on those bonds. And it's forcing people to take more risk than they want. And this is true not just for individuals, but for companies. So what we're seeing right now is what my client went on to say, sorry, was that what this is doing is it's supporting the day traders. But you could also say it's supporting companies that are taking outsized risk, because money is essentially free right now, right? There's just no return to be had, and there's no demand to have return on risk when debt is free. So that's something that we've been thinking about a lot, and we've been thinking about like where interest rates go and what the Fed does. And the Fed has said we're not even thinking about raising interest rates right now. So
not even thinking about it. Okay.
Yeah. And one of the things we look at is JP Morgan puts out a piece every quarter, and they show, and I don't have the exact number at hand, but they show something like 20 years ago, if you had $100,000 in 6 month CDs, you'd get something like $3,000 of interest. Today, you get like $150 of interest. It's just a meaningless amount that you get. And so I keep thinking about this and keep thinking about what it forces everyday investors to do and how damaging that is. And it's clearly not something that's in the Federal Reserve or the government's consideration when they lower interest rates. Taking this a step further.
Well, because they're looking at the bigger economy, not what it's doing to individual investors so much.
Right. And not feeling what the trickle out effects are of that, which is forcing everybody to take more risk than they want to, or more risk than they're comfortable with.
It's interesting you say that, because, you know, I probably am considered an extremely conservative investor, not much risk going on. And it was you know, there's been a couple times where I had like a small amount of money that came from something and had to be invested. And so I'm like, well, that's a small amount. I'm like, I'm going to go for a higher risk something and just give it a shot with this little amount, not risking like everything else, but just that small amount. So now I'm listening to you, I'm like, have I fallen into that category and I don't realize it? I don't know.
I don't know because I know what the balance of your overall portfolio is. But I had a tough conversation with a different client the other day where if I'd been working with this same person, you know, it's an individual, they've worked their entire life, they've just retired, they have about $1 million saved up. And if this was the same conversation 8 years ago, I'd say, great, let's put 30% of your portfolio into bonds. And the conversation I have today is, I'm so sorry, but you can't afford to have bonds. Because if you want to sustain the income that you need to live on, you can't afford to have bonds.
Because they're not returning enough.
No, yeah. No, they're just not. In fact, today I was looking at some bonds for sale, and even if you were to buy high yield bonds and go out about 5 years, so a bond in a high yield company that matures 5 years from now, the best you're going to get is between 2.5% and 3.5% a year return. And that's taking a lot of risk when you're buying a high yield bond. Whereas 10 years ago, you could buy municipal bonds, AAA municipal bonds, and you could get 3.5% to 5%. For really good, like New York, well, okay, maybe I'm, you know, stepping in it right now, but for like New York City bonds or really high quality bonds, you get real return. You just can't find that now. It's very damaging.
So is there anything out there that really matches the returns that people used to get, even though they're higher risk, or is everything kind of returning less now?
So you can get the same income return,
right?
But you're much higher risk. So I manage a dividend income portfolio, and that has a much higher yield on it. It's over 5%, but make no mistake, it is all stocks, and stocks are much higher risk than bonds. So in 2008, 2009, 2010, you could buy 5% tax-free municipal bonds, super low risk. Today, to get that same 5%, your only choice really is stocks. There's nothing in a low-risk category out there anymore that will actually give you a good steady return. And if someone's telling you that there is, they're not telling you the truth.
Yeah, they question them because they're missing something. Yeah.
Yeah, question them very hard.
Right.
If anyone tells you get 5% and it's low risk, that is not true. Yeah. It is not available. It is not available globally.
Okay. And I think people do understand that stocks are higher risk because that's what they hear about all the time. So we're going to take a break, traffic and weather here. We're also going to check news at the bottom of the hour. We'll come back and talk more with Jenny. And if you have questions, she'll probably answer them. 203-333-9422, or do her best, you know. But right now, traffic, weather, and news on WICC 600. And Ann Carrick here, your guest host for another day, 3 days this week. And you heard the announcer there, 203-333-9422, if you want to ask questions. My guest this hour is Jenny Van Leeuwen-Harrington with Gilman Hill Asset Management. So we're talking about money and markets and mayhem, because we've had a lot of that this year. And so we left talking about the fact that there really are no low-risk investment areas at the moment that return much of anything. And you said globally. So if somebody is saying they have a 5% return and it's a low risk, they're either uninformed or lying, basically. Mm-hmm. So what do like individual people, I mean, I would imagine that no one is really suggesting that they take all their money and put it into a high risk scenario.
Well, I think it's how you define high risk. You know, one could buy an all stock portfolio and as long as they have a really long time horizon, know what they're getting in for, know what their cash flows are, you could say this isn't high risk to me. But just acknowledge the fact that stocks are always going to be riskier than bonds with respect to market value fluctuation. You could argue, and frequently I do, that for certain individuals in their situation, in their specific situation, it would be riskier for them to have an all bond portfolio than an all stock portfolio. Because perhaps let's say you're retired and you have, you know, just for the sake of ease, you've got $1 million and you spend $50,000 a year and you were to buy an all bond portfolio right now and you only had a 1% yield on it or 1.5% yield, that portfolio would only last you maybe 23 or 24 years. That then becomes that risky thing for you to do. You're forced into stocks. Theoretically, stocks should return more than 1% a year, even though there's a lot of fluctuation.
Right.
So it would be actually less risky to your personal situation to have an all stock portfolio versus an all bond portfolio. But inherently, stocks are riskier because they see much more market value fluctuation than a bond portfolio does. But I want to say one thing. In our office, we've been talking about, like, so how do we get out of this? And what we think is the very realistic situation is that, well, right now, I just want to say interest rates right now, which we were talking about before, are negative. So you could say we have negative real interest rates because interest rates are lower than inflation, which means that if you buy a bond, you're actually kind of losing money versus, and if you buy a bond that's going to return 1% and inflation is 2.5%.
Then you're losing money all the time.
You're losing money all the time. Yeah. Your dollars become less in future value. So right now we have negative real interest rates. Historically, those are always temporary and something changes. And what we're thinking the changes right now that hopefully will start to rectify this is, and this is what we think people are kind of missing out on, is that a vaccine is likely to be here. And when it gets here, we think it might release a huge amount of pent-up demand. And people are going to start to spend again. And the savings rate has gone from like an average of 7 or 8% up to almost 30%. I think now it's in the 15% range. But the savings rate is still very high. And as dollars move...
And just to clarify, you're saying savings rate mean how much people are saving themselves.
Right. How much you're saving this month because you didn't go on vacation.
Right.
Yeah. So as money moves from saving to spending, we may see inflation. Inflation drives up interest rates regardless of what the Federal Reserve is doing. If that might then start to actually raise the interest rates on bonds out there, that could start to rectify this. The government, I think, is probably hoping for this, as is the Fed, because if we have inflation, that lowers the value of the debt that we've taken on. So right. That's a realistic way that we end up more okay and that the value of the debt is lowered and the government gets out of the huge, not completely, but mitigates the pain of the huge mountain of debt that's been accumulated.
Sure. You know, and you also said that you made a point back way back there that, you know, some companies are really thriving. And so it takes time, though, for people to shift from what they used to do to some new industry or, you know, in other words, like if their company's not thriving, they've lost their job. There's a gap of time there before they find the company that needs them that's thriving.
Right. And I think we're in that interim period right now, and that's what's creating a lot of emotional anxiety.
Okay.
I don't know about you, Anne, but everywhere I go, I'm seeing these Amazon vans on the road, and I'm thinking probably some of the people driving those were working in restaurants or movie theaters.
Right, exactly.
Position.
Okay, we're going to check. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just gonna, we're going to see a lot of transitions like that.
Okay. We're going to check traffic and weather again. We'll come back here on WICC 600 and talk more with Jenny Van Leeuwen Harrington.
Thanks.
Ann Carrick here, your guest host, my guest, Jenny Van Leeuwen Harrington. And, you know, during the break, you were talking about the market is showing some signs that reminds you of 1999. So why don't you explain for people what you were talking about there?
Sure. So in 1999, I was sitting on the desk at Goldman Sachs and the internet bubble was inflating like crazy. And what we saw back then were... I like to call them story stocks. So there were stories, amazing stories about how this company and that company, DoubleClick and ValueClick and Ciena and some companies that are still around. In fact, I don't even remember talking about Amazon very much in 99. It was other companies that were out there, but and Juniper. There were all sorts of big, crazy companies, and they would do their initial public offering, and the stock would be up several 100%, and no one was talking about earnings or cash flows and how that mattered or when that would matter. And what I'm seeing today are a lot of flashbacks to then. And if you'd asked me this a month and a half ago, I would say there's some similarities, there's some echoes, maybe 2 months ago, but I wouldn't have said it's very similar. And then in the last maybe about 5 or 6 weeks ago, things got a bit crazy. So what we saw was Apple and Tesla announced share splits, right? So if you owned one share of Tesla, you now own four shares. Same dollar value, no economic value added, nothing changing. They just said you own $1,200 worth of, or whatever it was, $1,600 worth of Tesla. You still own $1,600 worth of Tesla, but now you own it in four shares, not one. Same with Apple. And we saw Tesla run up like 95% after that was announced. And we saw Apple run up like 50% after that was announced. Meanwhile, no economic value was added. And so this kind of mania really brought me back to what I saw in 1999, where stocks moved up based on nothing.
Yeah.
And stocks were valued based on stories. So right now, Ann and I are on Zoom. We were just talking about this. And I said, Zoom, for example, is going to earn maybe about 60 cents a share. 57 cents a share is the estimate that I'm looking at.
Okay.
And the stock's trading at $503 a share, which gives it a multiple, a price to value, a price to earnings multiple of 575 times. By way of comparison, you've got Pfizer, on the other hand, that is going to earn $2.88, trades at $35 a share, and has a multiple of 12.5 times. Zoom's a great story. Zoom's an amazing. But are they really ever going to earn as much as Pfizer? There is so much competition in this space. We were talking about Google Meets, Microsoft Teams, Cisco's WebEx, RingCentral. There's a million things. But Zoom is trading on story, not on a logical set of cash flows that investors, not traders, should expect to return. So I've seen a lot of stories out there and not a lot of propping up stocks and not a lot of conversations about the cash that's going to flow. I think what we've seen kind of since the S&P peaked on September 2nd is I think we've started to see a rationalization of those. And we have seen the big mega cap story stocks start to fade a little bit, as they should. That's healthy. And on a relative basis, the cash flow, more cash flow oriented companies, the kind of old school, slow and steady, pump out a lot of cash flow, we've seen them make up some relative progress compared to the story.
I was going to say, I've always found it fascinating when you have companies, and you mentioned Amazon, you know, like that, where they're like wildly popular, they're doing crazy business, but they're not actually profitable. You know what I'm saying? And those, to me, it doesn't make sense in my head. I mean, I realize people make money by investing in it, but in my head, I'm like, how is it that we're making money on a company that itself is not profitable? What am I missing here?
Right.
You know?
Well, in the case of Amazon, to be fair, Amazon is very profitable. But here's another example. We looked this up. Amazon is profitable. They should earn about $26 a share. I believe that comes out to about $16 billion this year. So they should earn. Not their revenues. Revenues are a gazillion dollars.
Right.
But they should earn about $16 billion a year this year. Intel, and now remember, it trades at 100 times earnings. Intel, which everybody hates now, and is, you know, is just getting a very unpopular perspective by the market pundits. And they have misstepped a little bit. But guess what? Intel's going to earn $15 billion this year. And Intel trades at 9 times earnings and $48 a share. Amazon is growing way faster.
Right.
But Amazon has become a behemoth. And when you become that big, you cannot maintain that kind of growth rate. So the multiple that's being ascribed to Amazon right now, which is profitable, but that, to me, that supposes that Amazon's growth continues on at the same rate that it's been. It's not going to. One of the terms that I've really fixated on is magnitude of growth versus sustainability of growth. And I think there's a disproportionate focus right now on the magnitude of growth out there and not how sustainable those growth rates actually are.
Okay. All right. We got to take a break here coming up soon. You know, and I'm not sure I didn't miss a break again. I've done that once before. But oh, no, I'm being told no, I haven't. Oh, good. Yay. but yes, we're going to check traffic and weather. We'll come back and finish up with Jenny. Well, we have a couple more breaks there. But again, if you have a question, this might be your last chance to hear it. WICC 600 traffic and weather right now. And Ann Carrick here, your guest host for the day. And we have my guest is Jenny Van Leeuwen Harrington with Gilman Hill Asset Management. And I understand we have two people with questions for you, Jenny. So we're going to go to Dave in Southport first and find out what the question is. So Dave, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. And what did you want to ask Jenny?
Hey, I have a book on seasonal investing, and it normally says that September and October are the most dangerous time of the year. And I've taken a lot of courses in economic history. It seems to bear out. What do we do after? There'll probably be some kind of crash in the next couple of months. What do we do after the crash? Where do we, from the debris, there probably should be some opportunities. And what's your suggestion besides Pfizer?
Okay, let me make sure. I'm going to have to repeat your question so she can hear you. So Dave is saying he has a book that says that September and October are the most dangerous months for investing and that there's likely to be a crash coming soon. And what do we do after the crash besides Pfizer?
Okay. So I always like to call a little bit of baloney on those things that say, like, sell in May, go away, or September's always the worst month. I think when you look at the actual statistics for that, they're not, everybody likes something that grabs a headline, right? We're in a clickbait society. And so if you say September's always the worst month, we're due for a crash, you're gonna get a bazillion clicks. And I wish if I'd had time on this and known you were gonna ask this ahead of time, I would have researched it and looked at what September actually adds up to. But the reality is it's probably not really that terrible. It might be the worst month, but I don't know by what margin it's the worst month by. With respect to October and the most dangerous, I think if you are a real investor and you're actually in this for the long run, don't be dumb and don't sell out just because of 2 months. You may be wrong. There is a really good chance that you're going to be wrong. And I think I'd rather be patient and focus on what I know to be 100% true versus what may or may not be true in 2 months. And what I know to be 100% true is that I can look at a graph of the stock market over any reasonably long period of time, and it's going to be positive. In fact, over on my shelf there, I've got this terrific book. It's called The Laws of Wealth. And right in the beginning, it shows you this amazing chart, and it shows that even the worst, it shows every single 20-year period of the market since like 1920, so including the Great Depression, and it shows that for any 20-year period of the market, even the very worst 20-year period was still positive. And so I remember that, and I know where I stand, which is not trying to be a cutesy trader who may or may not be right, but I'm in it for the long run. I've got my eye on the horizon, and I don't make bets based on 2 months. I invest in companies that I know will return cash to me over the long run. So I would try not to get too spooked or too freaked out over September and October being the most dangerous.
And what about the fact that it was also saying that a crash is probably coming? Or is that tied to the dangerous months?
It's clickbait. Yeah. Like, if you want to get followers or clicks, you're going to write that because it's going to attract people.
Like, oh my God, there's going to be a crash. Click on this to find out why. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I did a terrific internship when I was in college. And one of the projects that I worked on was we went back for 20 years from 1996 when I did this, like back into the 70s, and took the top 120 market strategists and technicians and looked at every single thing they said and graphed it versus the Dow. So, oh, the market's going to be up huge. Oh, we're going to have a crash. And guess what? They're all wrong all the time. Some of them get lucky. Elaine Garzarelli got lucky in 1987. Ralph Acampora got lucky. They get lucky, but they're all wrong all the time. But they're not stupid. They're smart. They make good decisions. But just those headlines, there's so much nuance behind it.
Yeah.
So be careful of reacting to inflammatory headlines.
Okay. All right. So that was Dave's question. And so now we're going to go to Phil in Wilton and get his question before we have to go to traffic. So, Phil, what was your question for Jenny?
Jenny, you haven't discussed covered calls. As an individual investor, I get, especially with middle market companies, forget the Amazons and the Teslas, with the covered, I earn generally between 3.5% and 8% a week. And if the stock doesn't go up or go over to the strike price, I still own the stock and I sell it again. And by the way, and then I sell it again.
All right. Now, since I have to repeat the question so she can hear it, let me just start with the basic question and see if she covers it, which is he wanted to know why we haven't talked about it, covered calls. Or why the calls aren't done. Okay.
Yes.
I mean, he elaborated with some percentages, but I think that was the basic question, right, Phil?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Is there nuance to that?
You're asking me, and I'm like the middle person who doesn't know exactly.
So, covered calls, I think, my guess is he's asking, couldn't you write covered calls probably as an insurance strategy for a major market meltdown? And I think that's exactly the key, is it's insurance and you pay for insurance. So if you are a long-term investor and you know you've got this stuck out for the long term and you're always buying insurance and you know what the end game is, which is the market's going to be up, then you wasted a lot of money paying for insurance. If you have a unique short-term situation, maybe you have a portfolio that has huge embedded capital gains, maybe you have a relatively short time period, you can't take risk, maybe then you pay for the insurance and write some covered calls. But again, it depends. So covered call writing is so unique to each person's individual situation. It's not just a, here's a wonderful way to invest for the long term. It's really, you know, a lot of traders use them or think of them as insurance.
Okay.
But there's not a broad answer to that other than to say they're useful for unique situations.
All right. And we're going to go to traffic and weather again here on WICC 600. And news, of course, is coming up at the top of the hour. And I'm Ann Carrick, your guest host today. My guest has been Jenny Van Leeuwen Harrington. And we have about 40 seconds left, Jenny. So any parting words you want to give to people? We've talked about the emotions of the market and, you know, a whole bunch of things. But what do you want to leave people with in the last 30 seconds?
I think I'd be wary of clickbait. Be extremely wary of anything that's proclaimed to be low risk with a really great return. And keep your eye on the horizon as an investor. Look out to the long run.
Okay. Good advice all the time, probably, especially now. And now we'll check news at the top of the hour. We come back, we will get a follow-up from Pura.